if we were going to have recordings for the rest of the class. The answer is, I'm going to keep putting up the odd formats, and I'm going to keep taking them, and as soon as I have conversion software that works, or somebody steps up and says, I'll help, which I asked for on the list, I'll get MP3s out. But at the moment, I have no way to put MP3s on the web. Okay. So, does anybody know of an odd decoder that will work on Windows? Because I assume that's where most people are listening.
Audacity's free software and music. You have to use the lame MP3 encoder, but...
No, that's not the question. I am using a lame MP3 encoder. The status of the lame MP3 encoder on Linux right now is in the core dumps.
You can't just go back to an old version?
No, I'm trying. I tried. The problem is nobody knows where it's core dumping, and it looks like a library issue that somebody stepped on. I'm going to try to go forward to FC5. I have an FC5 machine, and I'm going to try it there. Could get lucky. But barring figuring out how to do the encoding, I'm kind of in a bind. And if somebody has the tools to take a WAV file and encode it to MP3 and will simply do the encode for me, that would be very helpful. I'm surprised that the stuff that's in my audio studio gear can't obviously do this, and I'm sure it can. I'm sure that if I had 3 hours to spend digging through the manual, I could figure it out. Maybe what I'll do is I'll try setting up an audio track and just inserting the WAV files, an ungodly long patch, and then mastering that stuff to MP3 and see what happens. I'll give it a shot. What a hassle. Okay, capabilities. So, what I tried to do yesterday is give a sense of context on what's the sort of security problem overall. And I have to say that if you ask people in the field, right, they'll say that security is about policy and about misbehavior. And so they have a policy, and it's not a policy in any technical sense. It's not a policy in the sense of a rule you can actually enforce. It's a policy in a social sense. It's an expectation of bad behavior. And not being enforceable, of course, they find some percentage of people misbehave. Much of that misbehavior is benign. The person at the bank who puts the modem at their desk is not trying to compromise the security of the bank. They're trying to get their job done. So this is ignorant misbehavior, well-intentioned misbehavior, but no less dangerous for being ignorant. It's like, don't carry matches around the bottom of the space shuttle either. The fact that you didn't intend to make the thing go boom won't make you any less dead after it happens. Sorry. And so, what they want is to get from social policy to policy in some computational sense of something they can enforce. Or at least, remember that the goal here is to impact human behavior in most deployments. At least something where if they can't ultimately prevent the behavior, they want to be able to audit the behavior in enough places to make it plausible that they'll have a chance in hindsight to know the behavior happened. Maybe even to detect the behavior before it's becoming a pattern. Right? It's not the one time the guy logs in on the modem that's the problem, right? It's two or three times the fact that now the number's been exposed for a while. I really want to get this thing off my neck. And, ideally, to get the users convinced that their behavior is being monitored tightly enough that ignoring that small fraction of users that really is hostile, right? that those people who are really out to get you will not be innocently abetted by those people who simply don't know any better and ignore the rules in some local sense for the sake of convenience or for the sake of meeting an objective. So, if you want to knock out 95% of the security violations in an institution, right, mechanisms for audit and occasional watchfulness that are not preventative mechanisms are actually extremely effective. Right? They will knock out the innocent abettor with high likelihood. And even if you don't get them all, it makes it much harder for the malicious attacker to find those innocent holes. Right? Because the problem is, everybody with a machine at their desktop doesn't realize it, but every one of those persons is a system administrator. And they're not knowledgeable enough to know the policy. So the more of them you can cut out of the system administration loop through any means you can bring to bear, social, delusion, okay, is good. Now you get to the heart. Some small fraction of people who actually are out to get you. And these guys divide into two categories. They are insider and outsider. Now, the one everybody focuses on, if you go out and look at products in the store, outsider. This is the party that Norton antivirus goes after. This is the party that Norton firewall or Windows firewall goes after, right? This is the party that's trying to break into a machine. Assuming you're not a bank, for a couple of possible values of a bank, but some company like that, there are no interesting outsiders. I'm really not interested in your baby photographs. There's just nothing on your PC I want. Except the PC. I want the PC because I want to go after a bank. And I want to go after a bank from 100,000 locations. And perversely, there is now a real elastic economic market for acquiring PCs. You can go. There are organizations currently primarily based in Eastern Europe. You can go to them for a surprisingly modest amount of money. You can obtain from them the addresses of and entry criteria for 100,000 zombie machines around the world. Price per zombie is currently running about 60 cents. It's a hell of a business. How do those guys get paid? Well, obviously nobody admits that they're in the business of selling zombies for penetration purposes. But the people who do spyware and adware and advertisement placement pop-ups, you may have heard of spyware, these guys can pay $1 per seat. And they operate through middlemen. It's a franchise business. And the people publishing spyware conspicuously do not ask the franchisees where they got the seats. And the franchisees then, as you work your way down the food chain with people not asking questions, as you get towards the bottom, the players playing get grayer and grayer and grayer until you get to the hackers, who are the ones that are serving up the zombies. The standard trick here is, you break in, you leave a hole that's designed for later exploit only by you, and then you back out. And 3 months later, that machine, suddenly it is serving pop-ups on it. So there's a real economy for this stuff. You can make $1 million a week breaking into people's machines. It's not just for kiddies. And the National Security Agency is finally on public with those numbers we can now talk about. So there is an outsider threat, but the outsider threat, unless you're a bank, is not to your information, it's to your platform as a tool for attacking banks or as a target for installation of software you don't want. There's a piece of good news lurking in there, which is the party who's trying to put ad software on your machine. Actually, it's very much in their interest for your machine to keep working mostly right. They're not at the amateur machine. They're at the studio cycles, your human cycles. But there are now people paying people to break into your Windows box. Because I can do it on this, right? It's not that I'm breaking into your Windows box, I'm breaking into everybody's Windows box, and there's no real money in it. Believe me, I can make a lot more money breaking into your homes, electronically speaking, than I can working for Hopkins. Having said all that, that's not the serious threat. That break-in is relatively easy to defend against. The problem is we're using C. Because the method of this break-in, well, there are two problems. First half of the problem is we're using C. The second half of the problem is we're not organizing protection in our systems in a way that is defensible. And we get to the second half of it. Having said all of that, this one is not the serious problem. The outsider threat is not the serious problem. Because the outsider threat is a threat that we mostly know how to deal with and simply haven't been willing to accept the cost, the disruption. The real threat is the insider threat. The insider threat is the guy who hires on the bank and touches the accounting software to say, every time that you do a transaction, an update transaction, you're applying interest to account, take the last fractional quarter cent, which would otherwise be a round off error, right, and put it in my other account over here. This is called the salami technique. You slice the salami so thin and nobody will notice. By the way, I should maybe explain here that it's not that I've actually done all of these attacks myself. These are all classics. Okay. So, or the person who hired on an AC Delco, and Delco made a mistake, and they fired this person. I don't know what the circumstances were of the termination. It doesn't really matter. They made the mistake of allowing this person to return to their desk to collect their personal artifacts before leaving the building. They neglected to disable this person's account before allowing them back to their desk. And in the course of collecting their personal effects, this person deleted the AC Delco support point design database. All of it. They discovered belatedly that the backup mechanisms for the design database were not functioning. Backups are only good if they are recoverable. Delco learned the hard way in ways that these were not. And there was a 3-month delay in delivery of automobiles in the U.S. because Delco could not deliver smart building. And they were forced to reconstruct the database from disk-level forensics. The reason I know about that is it was Charles Smith who helped them do the reconstruction. And that one they've not publicly acknowledged anywhere as far as I know. The problem with the insider threat is this party is authorized to do what they did. You've got to be very careful here about two senses of authorized. Okay. We're in a terminology problem here. Because I don't really want the word permitted for this. So, what they did was not permitted. It's very clear that what these people did was an improper use of the computing systems in both cases. Absolutely clear. But it was authorized. When I say it was not permitted, I'm making a statement about human sociology, about the human understanding of what was legitimate behavior. When I say it was authorized, I'm making a statement about the operations that the software system was prepared to allow the human to do. And the point is, there's always a gap. Worse, because people want to take social policy and they ask, how can I embed that as computational policy? They then become confused to imagining that the computational policy and the social policy are the same. Generally, the computational policy is some approximation of the social policy. And so you get into these gaps between things that are permitted socially and things that are authorized computationally. And you can bet where the Delco database went. The first question was, is that authorized? Or how can that be authorized in the software system? The answer is, software doesn't know it's a database. Right? Software sees bits. The fundamental operations that the software controls are reads and writes and creates and destroys. So the permissions layer of the system has no insight that destroying a million records in the database is an unusual operation. What it sees is, this party has the right to delete records. And indeed, the right to delete records was a necessary requirement in order to operate the software that this party operated. Now, what this suggests is something that's perfectly obvious after you think about it for a minute, which is that there's a layering going on in the system. There is a layer of permissions, and now everything here I'm speaking about is computational. There's a layering of permissions. This is, what are the operations, the direct operations, that I'm able to perform on some object, some very low-level object? Object now in the operating system sense. Can I read or write a page? Can I start or stop a process? Right? Those are permissions. And the first question we have to ask is, who's I? And the answer doesn't start with a human being, because there aren't any humans inside a box. We're always talking about a subject and an object. Right? And we always have some arrow between them and some set of permissions. Right? This is just the graph of the node arc representation of the access matrix. Now, I said yesterday that the access matrix could get factored either way. You could hang this stuff off the object or you could hang it off the subject. And I'm going to proceed today on the unorthodox. Well, in fact, depending on your point of view, it's currently unorthodox, but in fact, the traditional way is again. I'm going to hang it off the subject. Okay? So I'm going to talk today in terms of capabilities. And the reason I'm going to talk in terms of capabilities is, if I do the discussion in terms of capabilities, there are compositional properties I can get out that I cannot get out if I do them in terms of access controls. And I want you to see these things because I want you to understand that they're possible, even though they're not delivered in the existing data. Now, above the permissions layer, you have a certain kind of policy with a lowercase p. Very nice of you to join us. Why now? Why is that my problem?
Sorry.
Then why are you interrupting? Alright. There's certain kinds of policies that you can use strictly by composing and analyzing permissions. For example, if I tell you that some subject can read some object, I'm going to use squares now for objects, and then inside that object I'm going to store a permission to some second object. Then maybe we can draw the conclusion that this subject can read state in the second object. Why? Well, it could pick up the authority from the first object, and then having that authority, it could now access the second. Now, I actually just injected something quite important. In an access control list, there are operations that grant authority, right? You chown something, you chmod something. Right? But there aren't a lot of operations that copy authority. Authorities are not first class. In a capability system, authorities are first class. And so in a capability system, to make this story work, we need four basic access rights. Which are historically known in the literature as read, write, take, and grant. So in order to reach in and extract this capability, I would also have to have take rights. The subject would also have take rights on object. In the absence of the team, the answer would be no, that subject cannot read object 2. Because it has no right to, because it has no way to obtain that authority to object 2. And object 1 is a passive object, and so object 1 will not exercise its right to object 2.
Could you explicitly define take and grant?
Take and grant is read and write of a capability as opposed to data. So I read data, I take a capability. I write data, I grant a capability. It's exactly load and store operations. What we're trying to distinguish is whether what we're loading and storing is capabilities or data. Does that help?
Yeah.
So in particular, one of the things that I kind of like to do is, suppose I started off with a graph of objects that are in some kind of communication relationship. And here's my graph. I'd like to know, is this graph confined? Confined means, if I were to put information into this, if I were to hand information inside a box, could it leak back out over any unauthorized channel of communication? Where the typical assumption is, you know, here's me, I'm the subject, and in order to send information in, I have the authority to write into the box. And the assumption is generally that since I have the authority to send in the box, I have the authority to tell it where it is then allowed to send. And by telling it where it's allowed to send, I'm authorizing the channel. So the guy standing outside, that's the party that makes the authorization decision. Why is confinement important? Because if I know this box is confined, then ignoring covert channel issues, I know it will keep secrets. Not because it's cooperative, but because it cannot do otherwise. It can't do secrets. And even in the face of covert channel, if I have a protected capability system, it cannot leak capabilities. Capabilities cannot be leaked by the kinds of wall bang or timing techniques that we're talking about. Now, this is actually quite nice. This means that if you hand me a virus and you want me to test it for you, and I run it inside a confinement boundary, it can't get out unless I let it out. Brings a whole new meaning to virus-safe computing, if I can borrow your term. So, and I want to suggest that the challenge of computer security is not to avoid the execution of hostile code. That's crazy. Right? From the demographics of developers that we talked about yesterday, there is no possible way to avoid running hostile code. There is no non-hostile code. It doesn't exist. The test of computer security is to run hostile code and survive. So, the firewall, the antivirus, that class of software is fundamentally built on the wrong model. In fact, if you go back to the firewall literature, you will look and you will see it was very consciously constructed, the idea of the firewall, as a placeholder until we had securable operating systems. It was understood this was not a viable long-term mechanism. So the test, if you want to ask, the system secure? Here's the test. I have a system. At the start of our experiment, we will assert that I'm in charge of it. I'm in control. I'm going to give you computational resource on this machine. I'm going to let you load any software you want. And you're going to run it within the environment that I establish. And it can do anything. It can try to crash the machine, it can exploit bad instructions, it can run through buffer overruns, it can try to overrun its authority. And when it's all over, if I'm still in charge of the machine, it's secure. Not, I mean, obviously, it's not shooting me just because I got lucky, you didn't hit the way out. What we're after is a constructive technique for a machine in which literally anybody can run any hostile software, I don't even care what it is. It's not a matter of accident that it didn't get out, it's a matter of design.
Well, the antivirus and the anti-spyware is also to protect the machine from the stupid user. Because if your user is willing to give that piece of malware whatever privilege it wants, it doesn't matter how well you design the system.
It's true that those are a bad way of protecting the user. But let's think about how that stuff gets into the system. Right? Well, it gets into the system through penetration. We know how to do that. And it gets into the system through attachments to email. And we know how to do that. Namely, run the email viewer inside your environment.
Spyware doesn't only get into your system through that. For example, you know, you download 100 smileys or for your email or new mouse cursors, and they follow along with that.
Uh-huh.
And so the user voluntarily downloads the software.
Yeah, so where do you have to be looking for?
I'm sorry? And then as they install, the anti-spyware pops up and warns them and blocks the install.
Why should that be? You're missing my point. The definition of a secure machine, which you get to download and install as much hardware, as much hostile software as you want, and the machine still needs to be in control. And it's not hard to do. The place where that story that you're telling goes wrong is the assumption that I'm going to download it, strip off the packaging that makes it safe, and then after stripping off the packaging, I'm going to save it and let it do something without control. The answer is don't do that. Antivirus exists because we don't package our software safe. I should never be downloading a smiley face that does not operate in a confinement account. And there's no reason that a smiley face should ever have to not operate in a confinement account. The reason that we have this problem in current systems is current systems can't implement confinement account. And so we're left to secondary, approximate, half-assed measures. If they're half-assed, that might be going too far in your favor. So I want to propose to you that the right view of a smiley face is, it's not a file. It's a piece of code. It's a piece of code that's presumptively out to get me. And I should never execute it outside of my environment. And the only interface that I should let you use to talk to me is a bitmap interface. And if the only thing you can hand me is a bitmap, then the only thing you can do inside the confinement gallery is use two CPU cycles. And if he uses two CPU cycles, I'll shoot the little thing. Right now, the problem is, I run that code, really what happens is I hand it to an imaging library. The imaging library has an exploit. Right? The compressed image of the icon or whatever it is I'm doing exploits the vulnerability from the library to gain execution control of the library, right? And then it bootstraps from there. Well, if that execution bootstrapping, the hostile bootstrapping, were happening inside a confinement boundary, it wouldn't matter. There's no reason why it shouldn't. And that's why I wanted to point this out, is this is a fundamental system building block, and the fact that our systems don't have those is a serious problem.
Is there a mechanism for asking for more permissions than you currently have?
Who's you?
I should say, is there a mechanism for a subject to ask for more permissions from the user?
This depends on a bunch of details in the design, and there are a couple of answers. I'm going to say no with a caveat that in this kind of system, most applications will run with something that it's sort of a bundle of initial permissions. So you do, in order to implement current user interfaces, you need things like a way of saying, I need to open a file. That's not the same as saying, I need to access the file system. So I'm getting ahead of myself, and I want to come back to this. Let me roll forward a little bit longer, and I'll come back to that. All right. There are certain policies that we can build based solely on analysis of permissions. We can show that those policies are enforceable without regard to what code executes. Doesn't matter what. And confinement, fortunately, is one of those, because if you think about the system as building progressively bigger building blocks, we really want to have high confidence in the building blocks at the bottom, because everything above them sits on top of them. So the lower down you get the system, the more conservative you want to be about getting things right, or knowing that we did. Now here's the interesting part. I want to go back to the Delco here. So let me call these statically enforceable policies. And I'm using the term statically in some somewhat strange way, because this is a kind of analysis that we can do based on a static initial configuration, but the actual mechanism takes into account some amount of dynamic behavior. This analysis concludes, starting from the initial configuration, conservatively based on static analysis, we're not going to look at code behavior, how might the graph evolve? So it's a semi-static, semi-dynamic analysis. But then we have application policy. And this brings us into the Delco story. So the problem with the Delco story was that giving out permissions at the level of read, write, add record, drop record was the wrong granularity at which to capture this problem. Actually, there were two distinct problems. What happens as you move up the semantic functional stack? Right, is you need to express permissions in terms of semantically higher units. Right? Mere aggregation of smaller steps in unusual ways can lead to problems. So, at the database level, we are able to observe the difference between deleting a record and deleting all records, or deleting the database. At the database level, we are able to see, okay, here's an operation the user's expected to be able to do. It has to do with adding the design element. I have to make sense that there's some modest number of deletes that might possibly happen in this operation, and if 5 billion of them happen, the chances are good something's wrong. And at that point, I should abort the transaction and not let the deletes go through. But this is the case where we're not checking whether the authority has been violated. Okay? So let me introduce the term authority. Permissions is the set of operations you're immediately able to do. I direct you to point to that object and I show right here, this access right gives me authority to do that operation. Authority is the transitive effect on the system that you can come to have by doing some sequence of those operations. And that distinction underneath is yours. This is Mark Miller, for those of you who haven't met him. Too often we reason about permissions, and what we need to reason about is consequences, that is to say, authority. The guys trying to convert social policy into security policy, they're not interested in whether you have read and write on a page. They're interested in whether you can damage some company database. They're interested in consequences. And they're trying to reflect that back into the permission structure, which is very, very hard. And usually on the side of it. So, the problem is that as we move up the semantic stack, even the permissions we want to talk about become higher and higher level. Looking at the level of reads and writes, you can't get a lot of insight into what these operations mean in the database level, We certainly can't get a lot of insight into what these applications, what these operations mean at the layer of the human resources management application. And so what we end up with is a notion that's become popular now in research world. Notion of application-based security. So the observation is, look, applications are things that our businesses are critically dependent on. And for better or worse, we can't talk about permissions rationally without some help, some insight into what the application does. And there are policies that an application might help us build. And the good news is, the sanity checking module is actually much smaller than the application itself. But, so application-based or application-driven. So we may want to say, hey, I'm going to give you an application to talk to the database, but I'm going to put a security monitor in there, and that security monitor is going to check what you're doing in an application-specific way. Okay, I need to get to two questions. Okay, first problem with access controls. Excuse me. It's not a problem with access controls. It's a problem with access controls-based systems. When anybody talks to you about an Apple system, there is an assumption that everything is going to get expressed in terms of principles. I showed you the Lambson access matrix yesterday. I said it was about subjects and objects, and in one way it was an apple, and the other was a capability. That's bullshit. Even though I'm on tape, I'm really going to call it that, and if Butler doesn't like it, he can call me out in the line later. Anyone who knows Butler's phone number, be sure to send him mine. Actually, Butler has one, you know, so it's okay. The problem you have in an access control list, the subject, object, and permission have to have a persistent identity. Because when we shut the system down, we can't afford to lose the permission information. And so a consequence of this is, in a conventional system, we can't use subjects. The objects are going to continue to exist. The permissions are sort of mathematically defined, right? They have intrinsic durability. The value of one does not change its meaning simply because we turn off the power. Unfortunately, the processes do die in a conventional system. That actually is why access controllers were hot off of the objects. And because the processes die, we can't actually use the subject as the marker in that position in access controllers. So the paper access controllers is a paper diagram. It's a model that can't be implemented in real life. So when you see a research paper comparing the subject right object model for capabilities and access control lists, including anything at all, throw the paper out, run it through the shredder, and send the author some piece of email politely telling them what an asshole they are. Something certain of my students have not hesitated to do. The problem is, now, Mark, I wasn't going to disclose this to you. So the problem is the subject thing has no persistent identity. That's why we assign UIDs in this design. And as we all know, UID has a lot to do with the user. No, UID is the name of a record in the database. So, in place of this subject, right, what you actually find in an access control list in the wild is a UID. And now you start to see the shape of the Unix permissions model, which is not quite an access control list, although recent implementations have augmented with access control. Now, the problem with this UID is, this UID is actually a shorthand.
Record authority.
By the way, in practice, if we're going to carry through this design, I don't have time to do it on the board today, we crack this up a lot more and we break out our authorities somewhat more finely. I'm trying to get the idea of this. Now, how is this story different from the story on Unix, which was, or maybe it was EMS, I don't know which, I think it was Unix, that Delco actually is. This application lives inside a confinement boundary. This application lives inside a confinement boundary. The truth of the matter is the Delco employee was an idiot. Because if he thought about it for a minute, he would have just logged into the server and deleted the file containing the data. And that would bypass the application entirely. He didn't need to delete all the records one at a time. Thankfully, he did, because it enabled the forensic recovery. What we want is a way to say, look, the only way you talk to this part of the database is to be an application that we wrote, and by virtue of having written the application, we know exactly what updates are going to be done. And those updates are not purely a function of the permissions. They're a function of known behavior of known code wielding those permissions. And you want to write some other code that touches the database? Right away! We're not going to give that code permission to touch the database. It's not just, can Fred connect to this table? It's, can Fred connect to this table using a particular application? And that's application-based security. And at that point, we can also write mediators in here that say things like, you know, after 15th delete this operation, it's kind of smelling a little yucky here. I'm not sure I need it anymore. But this whole model of being able to do application-based monitoring, it's not feasible in an access control list system because people can form connections that just go around the official application. The reason that they can go around is that their permissions weren't based on subjects. They were based on equivalence classes.
How come you can't just create accounts for the applications in the database that use the traditional database permission?
You can, but then you get pushed back there, which is once you create those accounts for those applications, now the question is how does the user's account get the authority to talk to those accounts? And if they have the authority to talk to those accounts, now you're back at the same problem, which is, well, if they have the authority to talk to those accounts, now we've got to make sure they don't have the authority to create new applications in those accounts. So what we want is a scenario in which the authority, the effect you can have on the system, is a consequence, is something that you can work out by starting with the software and tracing the permissions, the capabilities that the software holds, until you understand where it can get to and which software is actually doing what and who's in control of that software. So capabilities let us do that because they give us exactly the kind of graph traceability that we need to have to do that analysis. I apologize for running late. Just a reminder, you're not meeting tomorrow because I didn't think I was doing it coming in this morning. Tomorrow, I'm going to be doing it in pain. Also started Passover, so many people wouldn't make it in any case. So we will resume on Monday. Swarup will be doing a series of lectures on Monday about virtual machines.
Are those the midterms?
Those are the midterms. I need to look them over before they get handed back.